Deacon Andrew Cuneo has been very gracious, got in touch with us, wants to talk to us a little bit about C.S. Lewis. I guess Dave Galloway let him know about us, and the name kind of made him feel nostalgic for when he hung out in the same pub where C.S. Lewis hung out. He's the first guy to get a doctorate in C.S. Lewis himself from Oxford University, the president of the C.S. Lewis Club while he was over there. And he's actually done some work with Walter Hooper. So if any of you guys have any questions about that later, we could definitely grill him on that. Without further ado, please welcome Deacon Andrew Cuneo.
Well, I must say, I am shocked. I'm shocked you all came out to hear me. I had no idea when I was coming down to the South that anything like this was going to happen, in fact. My reason for being down here in Greenville and in Greer was actually to visit and be an intern at a church just outside of Greenville called St. John of the Ladder, and to get some parish experience. So my purpose as a visiting seminarian was to visit a church, to get a feel for a real parish, and to escape academe. I am, just to clarify, the email that went out says I'm a professor at Hillsdale College, but I'm actually no longer a professor at Hillsdale College. I'm a student again. So despite having a doctorate in English, I'm now a mere student at St. Vladimir's Seminary up in New York by the city. And I have one more year to go with my wife and three kids. And then after that, Lord willing, I'll be a priest somewhere. So here we are. As I say, I'm amazed that you all came. And indeed, when I came down here, I didn't anticipate at all giving anything like a lecture on C.S. Lewis. So let's roll.
And then that happened totally by accident. I thought we'd have something cozy as well. But of course, glad everyone's here.
So I would say, let's, those who are in the back room, please feel free to come in and come as close as you'd like.
There's another seat over here.
Yeah, there's more seats and there's more space.
There's a room back here.
There's also some space back there.
Sofa back in it.
I've got about 30 handouts or so. So that would nearly cover the numbers here. So please take a handout to divert yourself while I'm speaking. You can go as long or as short as you'd like. I have no idea how long typically a speaker goes on here, but
3 hours.
One of the things that was really apparent in my 6 years living over in Oxford, and I think that one of the benefits of meeting people who knew C.S. Lewis and were his friends or his students or just had recollections from his lectures and things like that, is you start to realize that C.S. Lewis is a real person, and he's not an academic subject, and that matters. It matters in the sense that, what I say as somebody who never met C.S. Lewis, it's always subject to correction. And don't let me get away with silliness and nonsense. You all have read a great deal of Lewis, and I look forward to your contributions. So let's go at it that way. What I want to do today, because it's about the only Lewis book I brought with me to the South, is to return to one of my favorite books by him called The Abolition of Man. And I don't know if many of you have read it, or some of you have read it, or what your familiarity is with it, but when I was teaching undergraduates at Hillsdale College in Michigan, it just dawned upon me what a wonderful book about education it is. Because in this book, Lewis lays out what you might call a map of the soul. He lays out sort of what it is to be human as a precondition for what education ought to do, what its aim is for. And this is stunning. I mean, imagine if somebody sat you down and said, okay, take out a piece of paper, get your pencil, and draw a map of the soul. You know, we can do Mississippi, we can do New York, but the soul is a tricky thing. So looking at this book from the standpoint of an educator, certain passages just delighted me, and those are the passages I put down on the piece of paper for you. We'll look at them, they're pretty rich. And we'll have an indication of what Lewis was thinking about when he wrote The Abolition of Man. So it's a little bit on C.S. Lewis and education, a little bit on C.S. Lewis and the human person, and a little bit about C.S. Lewis and his apocalyptic vision, which may be happening right now. So that's what's on tap here. The very first thing that struck me when Lewis was writing The Abolition of Man was that he doesn't aim this book really to university students. he's writing about, in the very first chapter, he's writing about the formation of a child, the formation of somebody who hasn't yet reached the age of reason. And this is remarkable. He takes as his pretext a book on education for children in the English language and responds vehemently against it, takes great issue with that book of education, because the book itself starts to erode from a very early age the idea that in children we can train them to have objective responses to the universe. And Lewis doesn't like this. He realizes that at the vulnerable stage at which children are being formed, something has to start that process of getting them to be ready to be rational, objective, realist creatures. That's what Lewis is up to at the very get-go. But when he turns to children, he's looking at not so much their rational faculties, which you would think Lewis the early philosopher tutor, Lewis the debater, Lewis the apologist, would have aimed right at your head. But what he's really concerned about in the young soul is the formation of their feelings. This is a real surprise. What he wants to aim at, or what he wants to stress, is that before we even begin to think about getting the young mind or the young soul ready for reason, capital R, we have to get that young soul feeling appropriately. Take a look, if you will, at the first quotation here, where he makes an observation as a seasoned tutor of adolescence, and he tells us something that's a little bit shocking. Where's JP? JP, would you read the passage for me?
Sure. The first paragraph?
Sure.
Modern teachers have learned from tradition that youth is sentimental, and they conclude that the best thing they can do is to fortify the minds of young people against emotion. My own experience as a teacher tells the opposite tale. For every one pupil who needs to be guarded from a weak excess of sensibility, there are three who need to be awakened from the slumber of cold vulgarity. The task of the modern educator is not to cut down jungles, but to irrigate deserts.
This is a fascinating and rhetorically successful passage, I think you can see. Lewis is going back and thinking about his two T's, his pupils that he teaches. And he says, while the common assumption is that these pupils are sort of wild with the passions, they're flowing over with emotions, he says it's just the reverse. What we find in youth is not an excess of feelings, but a defect, what he calls sentiment. And this is very interesting. But think how true it is if you step back. What is it that makes a culture from, 11 to 19 require volume 11, on the iPod? What is it that makes them require a huge movie screen to begin to have an aesthetic reaction, to be entranced by a story? Why does it take that much? Why does it take 80,000 people crammed into a stadium for them to have something like an experience of exaltation, an emotional feel? Again, Lewis's point here is that youth is not overcome by feelings. It's as if they're sedate or anesthetized. It takes that much to get them going. You really have to turn it up, make it loud, make it big for them even to respond beyond the, huh. Do you see what's going on here? Lewis is seeing in 3 out of 4 of his students that what's at issue in early education is getting them to feel, to have right feelings, proportionate feelings, feelings that correspond to the reality of the world in which they live. It's an unusual thing because we usually conceive of education as aiming for the head, fill it with data, get them to be critical thinkers, which is a curious phrase that. But Lewis says, no, when it comes to English literature, half the battle is to get them to feel. There's an old story that a lot of the Orthodox people in this room will know about a person who went to Mount Athos in Greece, and he went to visit a monk who lived in a very remote hermitage and came to the monk's bare, sterile cell and found a picture of Charles Dickens on the wall and an icon, a single icon. And the new person to the hermitage said, why do you have a picture of Charles Dickens on your wall? He's not even Orthodox. And the monk replied, until you can start to have the basic humane feelings of little David Copperfield, you're not ready to go on to the spiritual qualities, to the spiritual life. One has to be human before you can be a saved human, if you will. So for Lewis, the role of literature, the role of poetry, is to groom the feelings, to enable the young man or the young woman to begin to feel about the world as he or she ought. And it's the ought that's the problem. Lewis is very old-fashioned insofar as he thinks that there can be appropriate feelings and appropriate emotions to the world around us and inappropriate feelings or inappropriate responses. If, in the case of the person who has to have the deserts irrigated, has to begin to feel, there's a sense in which Lewis thinks one must feel in concordance with the objective nature of the reality around one. In this book, The Abolition of Man, he gives the example of a cataract, a beautiful waterfall. And one person says, that's sublime, and another person says, that's pretty. And Lewis says, the person who said it was sublime was actually more objectively appropriate emotionally in his response to that thing which is the waterfall. It's a strange thing, but Lewis is driving at something like objective feelings alongside objective truths. That there are feelings which are correlative, objectively related to the things that they relate to. That's unusual. Most of us feel our feelings would be what they are. Feelings are ungovernable, uncontrollable. We feel what we feel. They're a little bit wild. Lewis, in response, says, no, the role of literature is to groom those feelings, to cultivate them, to help them flower, and to make them proportionate. To use an analogy from bodybuilding, if you will, it's as if literature for him is to tone the feelings, to build them up and to make them the right shape in accordance with the rest of your muscles on the body, the rest of the feelings in your soul. And that's the first step. Take a look at the second quotation, and you can see what he's up to, at least philosophically. The second passage, which begins until quite modern times. I think the man in the cap back there is going to read this for us.
Indeed, thank you. Until quite modern times, all teachers and even all men believed the universe to be such that certain emotional reactions on our part could be either congruous or incongruous to it. Believed, in fact, that objects did not merely receive but could merit our approval or disapproval, our reverence or our contempt.
It's a strong statement. The universe is construed in such a way that things, just raw things, not even actions, not even moral qualities yet, but things merit a response. Put it another way, it's as if the world demands a certain justice from our feelings. We ought to feel about Niagara Falls a certain way. We ought to feel about a painting by Rembrandt a certain way. We ought to respond to a symphony by Beethoven in a certain way. We ought to see the Arc de Triomphe with a certain emotional capacity. And when we don't have that emotional capacity, the defect isn't in the thing, it's in us. It's like that rather chilling story of a curator in an English museum who was taking around a group of young university students. And, you know, they came to some famous old master or other, and the students were, as usual, fairly unimpressed. And really, the students started to challenge the curator and guide and said, you know, I don't think it's that good. It's just, you know, it doesn't do much for me. And the curator replied rather archly, I don't recommend this. The curator replied, the value of the painting's not in question. It's your judgment that's in question. Right? There are certain things that it is a species of justice. They merit our responses. Not to give them that responses is a defect in us. Now, you can argue to the day's end as to what merit means with certain objects, but at least at the root, there's a presupposition that the objective nature of the aesthetic world demands an objective response with respect to our feeling, or rather a subjective response with respect to our feelings. Are we clear so far as to what Lewis is up to? When he's extending the next bit of the soul from aesthetic responses to moral responses, then we're onto more familiar territory, right? There are certain deeds that merit certain responses. There are certain deeds that should delight us, and there are certain deeds that should repel us. The moral world is objective enough, is realist enough, that it demands a certain response to us, both rationally and emotionally. So, on the one hand, getting the young soul, the young child, the pre-rational creature, to feel rightly about beauty is really important to us. Because that's a precursor for that young person to graduate to feeling rightly about ethical actions in the moral world. So let's go to the third passage, which is a very rich one indeed. You can see he relies on not just his own opinion, but some fairly serious thinkers. Let's see, could I have the man in the red shirt and carry on? Just read it nice and slowly in case those who don't have a sheet can hear.
St. Augustine defines virtue as ordo amoris, the ordinate condition of the affections in which every object is accorded that kind of degree of love which is appropriate to it. Aristotle says that the aim of education is to make the pupil like and dislike what he ought. When the age for reflective thought comes, the pupil who has been thus trained in ordinate affections or just sentiments will easily find the first principles in ethics. But to the corrupt man, they will never be visible at all, and he can make no progress in that science. Plato before him had said the same. The little human animal will not at first have the right responses. It must be trained to feel pleasure, liking, disgust, and hatred at those things which really are pleasant, likable, disgusting, and hateful. In the Republic, the well-nurtured youth is one, quote, who would see most clearly whatever was amiss in ill-made works of man or ill-grown works of nature, and with a just distaste would blame and hate the ugly even from his earliest years, and would give delighted praise to beauty, receiving it into his soul and being nourished by it, so that he becomes a man of gentle heart. All this before he is of an age to reason, so that when reason at length comes to him, he will hold out his hands in welcome and recognize her because of the affinity he bears to her.
That's right, thank you. Augustine, St. Augustine, Plato, Aristotle, onwards. Lewis gives you a picture of the human soul where education is helping that person respond to the world as he or she ought, in feelings and in moral actions. He calls these ordinate affections, or just sentiments. Remember what we said about justice here, being just to the world around you. When he quotes Plato, he says, the little human animal will not at first have the right responses. You have to train a person to feel pleasure, liking, and disgust at things that are truly pleasurable, liking, or disgusting. To give a fairly cheap example, it's the difference between walking into an exquisite, classically designed room with columns and marbles and art and feeling ennobled by it versus walking into most university classrooms, into a cinder block classroom that has absolutely no aesthetic appeal to it and feeling the same. One ought to respond aesthetically to that setting in a different way. One ought to respond to different settings appropriately, ordinately, justly, to the thing that they are. Lewis here says it has to be taught. You can't have a civilization without a civilized person. And you can't have a civilized person without a civilized heart. So to start with the map of the soul, the teacher, the educator, at least in Lewis's case through literature, aims right at civilizing the heart, feeling appropriately to the world around them. And he's deliberate when he says and quotes Plato about the little human animal, because it's our animal nature, you know, what Augustine would have called our appetitive nature, or what Plato would have called our eros, our appetites. It's that which has to be schooled, again, toned, or trained. And the moment you start to do that, the moment you subordinate your feelings to the rational nature of the world around you, you start to cultivate a habit. And this is what Lewis means by sentiment. Sentiment for Lewis is the chest. Sentiment for Lewis is the heart. Sentiment for Lewis is the nexus of your reason and your appetites in accordance with each other. Sentiments is the habitual feeling in response to the objective nature of the world, the habitual feeling to the aesthetic qualities of the world around you. It has to be trained. It has to be cultivated. And this is why Lewis objected to modernist poetry so much, because he thought it was ruining the sentiment. When T.S. Eliot, in the famous poem of the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, begins, "Let us go then, you and I, while the evening is spread out against the sky, like a patient etherized on a table," Lewis says, that's wrong. The poem is training the reader to feel in response to evening as if evening were sick, a patient etherized on a table. Training the reader to see nature as if it were diseased. And Lewis says, no, that's not what poetry and literature ought to do. It's there to train you to respond objectively to what evening always is. The passage of a great and a momentous thing. 24 hours you will never have again. A present which is priceless, not diseased. So shaping those feelings in the world of literature is crucial, because the feelings actually can be governed. They can be shaped. And your reason has to discern how to shape them. And the moment you wed those two faculties in your soul, you create that third part in the map of your soul, what Lewis calls the chest or the heart. And it's obvious why he locates it in the heart, because the heart is the locus of feeling. It's the locus of what he calls the stock response to the world. The stock responses to beauty that we have to cultivate, the stock responses to people that we have to cultivate, that they're all made in the image of God, the stock responses to nature that we have to cultivate, because if we don't, then the appetites will run wild. You will be what Lewis calls a man without a chest. So that's what he's up to. The map is your reason governing your appetites through the vehicle of the heart, the chest. And the toned feeling, or the trained sentiment, the stock response, is what Lewis means by the heart. Okay? It's rather interesting. I remember a colleague of Lewis, who was a junior colleague just when Lewis was leaving Magdalen College, Oxford. He said, Lewis was a convex man. He had a great chest. He was a great barrel-chested man. He did say Tolkien was a concave man, but that's a little bit unfair. Men with chest. Trained sentiment, trained feeling, feeling in accordance with the world around you. He gives you that map for a reason, and he thinks that it's important to return to the way the ancients thought of this, because so far as he can tell, when you have a situation where the objective nature of the universe is questioned, either aesthetically or morally, when you have a situation when most of the philosophy departments in this country would quite frankly be staffed by relativists, I kid you not, you will produce generation after generation of students who do not think there is an object of truth, either moral or aesthetic. You rob them of the capacity of forming a stock response. They can respond any way they want to a piece of music, to nature, to a person, to a moral deed, to a fetus, to marriage, to the sexual act. When you remove that faculty, when you rob them of the trained habit and the stock response, then you create the man without the chest. That's the danger Lewis sees. Create really good thinkers, really sharp people who don't believe in the natural law, a realist view of the universe, and are going to train others to think that. And then, and this is where you get to the apocalyptic part, and then get the sharpest minds, get the most scientifically capable people, and then put them in charge of some serious tools. If human nature is most human, you're most an anima rationalis, when you're both a rational animal and someone with a trained chest, if that is what makes us human and not just our DNA, and you rob them of that moral heritage, of that chest, then you've got a problem. If they've got maximum scientific ability, maximum state control, maximum educational ability, guess what you'll make? So that's the thing that he's worried about. And go to the fifth passage on your sheet. It's one after the passage we skipped, beginning, "I am only making clear what man's conquest of nature is." Maybe we could have a voice from the back there, the dad with the beer bottle standing up. Yes.
"I'm only making clear what man's conquest of nature really means, and especially that final stage of conquest, which perhaps is not far off. The final stage has come when man, by eugenics, by prenatal conditioning, and by an educational and propaganda based on a perfect applied psychology, has obtained full control over himself. Human nature will be the last part of nature to surrender to man."
Okay. Dwell a little bit on that sentence there. It's an extraordinary sentence. The final stage has come when man, by eugenics, think of Human Genome Project, by prenatal conditioning, and by education and propaganda, think of any entertainment industry, based on a perfect applied psychology, let's go to therapy, has obtained full control over himself. In other words, Lewis is forecasting a point in the scientific ascent when the scientist can look at the human mind and say, "I know what you're thinking, and I can change it scientifically or psychologically or educationally or aesthetically. We've got enough capacity in our brain scans to know what chemical to give you to change how you think." Or the point where you get to the genetic sequence where you can say, "We can create a moral response in you. We know which genes govern, say, love of parents. We know which genes govern fidelity to spouses. We know which genes can create patriotism, if you will, or what propaganda will generate anti-patriotism." When you've got maximum control, when you have that much skill over human nature and you're lacking the moral law, you have the confluence of two radically dangerous things for Lewis. That's his apocalyptic vision. You can create whatever you want because you've got perfect control of the human person. You've conquered human nature. But you haven't the slightest scruples about what kind of person you're going to make because you've long ago given up on the objective nature of humanity, long ago given up on the moral law. So then what do you get? You get what Lewis calls the post-human. Being human, again, is not about being a physical sack. Being human is being made into a rational animal, your reason wedded to your appetites in accordance with objective nature. And when you remove that, you don't have a human being any longer. You can certainly genetically create a 6'5", blonde-haired, blue-eyed species of perfection created in the gym. You can certainly create, through technical skill, a human being who can get 1600s on the SATs, though I know they've changed the grading system since I took it. You can make a perfect human in so many facets, but without that heart, without that trained sentiment, without that trained response, you don't have a human. You have what Lewis calls a post-human. So Lewis's vision of the apocalypse is, if you will, not the extermination of humans on the earth, you know, no more bipeds. It's the extermination of somebody who doesn't feel about the universe as they ought to, who doesn't feel about moral actions as they ought to. They still live, they still eat, they still breathe, they still make politics, but they're not humans. That's the danger. It's something that is so consonant with Lewis's vision of what he was up to in his apologetics that it's hard to overstate. Owen Barfield said that Lewis was like a man who was always taking his moral finals. And if you look at a book like Mere Christianity, where he spends half the book on trying to get the reader to believe in right and wrong as a clue to the meaning of the universe, to borrow his title, he's always trying to get people to return to the moral law. Because again, you can't graduate to Christianity until you acknowledge a moral law. You can't graduate to Christianity until you acknowledge a moral law that we failed to keep. The cool thing about the moral law for Lewis isn't that it exists. Everyone believes in the moral law. And so he quotes Egyptians, Jews, Hindus, you name it. all these folks believing in the objective nature of the moral universe. The cool thing about Christianity is that it says, here's what we do when we can't fulfill it. Here's the solution for our inability to respond to the objective world as it is. That's the difference of Christianity for me. So, as a little picture of the map of the human person, as a picture of what could be, if you really go the relativist route, this is astonishingly prophetic, I think you'd agree. But let's read the last passage and go one more step beyond just mere morality and more mere moralism. It's a beautiful passage, not from the abolition of man, but from mere Christianity. It might be familiar to many of you. Could I have the man in the blue shirt read that for us?
For mere improvement is not redemption, though redemption will always improve people here and now and will in the end improve them to a degree we cannot yet imagine. God became man to turn creatures into sons, not simply to produce better men of the old kind, but to produce a new kind of man. It is not like teaching a horse to jump better and better, but like turning a horse into a winged creature.
Yeah. It's a gorgeous passage. Again, Christianity for Lewis isn't making you a more pious person. It's not making you more moral so that you actually fulfill the law. That's not it at all. It's saying there is a moral law. We don't fulfill it. And we have to be remade. Not just somebody who's more finely attuned to the moral universe, but a new creature. Not somebody who's more aesthetically refined, and thus can appreciate all art, museums, and symphonies as they ought to be appreciated, but someone who recognizes that we are defective when it comes to our response to the beautiful, we're defective when it comes to our response to the good, as well as defective, as we all know, in our response to the true, our weak reason and corrupt reason. And with that problem, with that predicament, then you can baptize them all and aim at the new creature. So let me stop there, and we can open it up to discussion or queries, relevant or irrelevant, and we'll go from there. Any thoughts or reflections or objections or anything you want?
Well, it reminds me of the verse in Proverbs that I was reminded of years ago reading John Eldridge's Waking the Dead, which talks about to some extent, but the verse in Proverbs very much this, which says, above all else, guard your heart. Mm-hmm. For out of it comes the wellspring of life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So about the men without chest and the heart being so important, and guarding your heart from these insidious influences or untruth or wrong teachings.
Yeah, it's a good comment. I would caution insofar as the scriptures obviously don't use the word heart in any uniform definition in each book. But I think the verse that you give us is very much in accordance with what's going on here. Other thoughts or queries? Yes?
It seems to me that he's kind of begging the Gnostic question, which I believe is an indictment of sort of a modern form of Gnosticism, which, you know, even though nature is all that they recognize, it's still without, it's divorced from God. Mm, and therefore has really no purpose except what we give. Mm-hmm. I just wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah. Lewis has that wonderful line about Christians being the true materialists. God likes matter. He made it. Mm. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful line. And Lewis, if anyone, was a serious materialist in that richer sense of the word. There's no doubt that he would have considered nature to be, in religious terms, sacramental, as that which conveys the qualities of God, conveys certain qualities of the universe that are just inaccessible in it from any other way. That Lewis thought nature was religious in that sense, I think he would be very happy to admit, even in a fallen universe. So, Lewis's admiration for matter is, I think, undeniable, and his anti-Gnostic proclivities, in his respect for the body, I think, is undeniable too.
See, for me, having a background in, you know, fundamentalist Christianity, C.S. Lewis was the voice, and, you know, throughout my evolution that led me to an incarnational kind of understanding of who Christ is, that
That's right.
he is indeed God and man as well.
Isn't his vision at the end of the Narnia series, where you have a new Narnia, indicative that, you know, God came to save the whole cosmos, not just people, not just isolated souls, but the whole world? For the salvation of the world, the Logos was incarnate. And it's telling that he does give you a whole new world at the end of Narnia. That's important, even when we speak in a contemporary context about environmentalism. What is it to speak about the redemption of the world, and not just our precious little souls being saved from hellfire? Other thoughts?
I have a comment.
Sure.
I think obviously we know that most of the modern relativist philosophers, as you point out, would, you know, their response to Lewis would be, you're limiting us with saying there's objective response to right or wrong.
Sure.
And with you, I'm right on board with what Lewis is saying. How do you think Lewis would specifically respond to the charge? Because we know Lewis was perhaps the most liberated Christian thinker of modern times. Like he, you know, mere Christianity, he would say, I'm no religious authority. I'm a lay person.
Sure.
And this is how I've worked it out for myself. We know from A Grief Observed, he would say, you know, what I'm feeling right now, what I'm writing isn't even, I don't feel it's consistent with what I thought I believed to this point, but I'm going to be honest with myself and write about this anyway.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think he would respond to that charge that no doubt, like, modernist philosophers would say that, you know, it's old-fashioned, you're limiting us with saying there's objective response to things?
You know, I was searching around for a paper that I had saved on my computer and didn't find it before, by a philosopher who came to speak at the Oxford Lewis Society. And he made the quite fair point that Lewis is really philosophically behind the times. In other words, he's not responding to relativists and subjectivists that were making the cutting-edge arguments in the 1940s. That's true. You know, logical positivism is coming on the scene, and Lewis just really was unaware of this. He was also reasonably unaware of existentialism as it was coming around, and certainly wouldn't have understood postmodernism. So it's fair to say Lewis is an amateur philosopher. He's not a professional philosopher, and he's responding against a kind of emotivism that what I feel is true, that might be construed by a true relativist philosopher as unsophisticated. And so I think that's fair enough to say. There are some philosophers in the audience, so I don't mind if they chip in.
Just one more quick comment. I think there may have even been some common ground between them, in that Lewis has obviously argued one of his arguments is the argument of, I don't know how to word this, but feeling. The reason that there's Christianity and even a general belief in God even arose is because people felt it first, like this is probably true because I feel that there's something bigger and better than me.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that arose the intellectual arguments afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And in some sense, he shares that with the modern philosopher who would say, you know, our gut feelings can tell us a lot. And maybe they, you know, together they could, you know, find a common ground if they would understand each other.
Yeah, okay. I mean, insofar as reason can be a true avenue to the faith, then surely emotions can be a true avenue to the faith. I think for Lewis, the battle is always trying to rectify the feelings that we don't have and at least acknowledge them. He gives a good example of, he says, I don't like the company of children. And I recognize that's just a wrong response to the objective nature of innocence and of beauty, however fallen St. Augustine may have felt them to be. The war is always trying to shape your feelings, whether you've got them or not, to the thing that a baby is, or a waterfall is, or a Grand Canyon is, or a white room is. So that's a difficult task. And no, because we're finite, no one's going to feel fully or appropriately to the full nature of the universe. It's just impossible. But to recognize our limitations in that aesthetic arena is very important. And some might actually have a full and appropriate and rich feeling response to Christianity, and for others it may leave them cold. So I agree it can be a means to Christianity. I don't know how much it would be a bridge to the relativist. Other thoughts, Father Jacob?
For me, it's very interesting, and it seems to be a kind of parallel, you know, according to my way of thinking. On the one hand, the way Lewis describes the appropriateness of feelings of a the right quality, the world as it is, and the appropriate response to that world. Okay, we're talking about the appropriate response in terms of feeling. But really, you can describe rational capacity in the same kind of way.
Yes.
In the world, there is rational pattern. The human mind is able to respond to that rational pattern. There is no reason, you know, to put one over the other. You're just doing different things in two different cases with respect to an existing world within which we live and do one thing here and another thing over here. And in an overarching kind of way, you're doing the same sort of thing, but with different human capacities. So
mm-hmm.
why pit rational, the rational patterns that we find in the world against, you know, an appropriate, fully human response to those things that we find also in the world, no more authoritatively somehow in the world. Both of them are there.
Yeah, indeed. It's a tricky case because, you know, most of you will be familiar that human beings are just hybrid things, you know? They're hybrid insofar as they have one foot in the immaterial world, you know, the rational world, the world of ideas, the uncreated world, the world you can't touch, and they have another foot in the animal world, the material world. And part of being a true human is getting those in concert with each other. Again, becoming an animal rationalis, a rational animal, being both an angel and a beast, but not neither of them, and becoming a true human. That's a tricky thing, because most of us will err towards one side or the other. We'll live in the world of ideas, our Christianity will be really in the head, or we'll live in the world of tangible physical reality. We'll live like animals. Both are, in some senses, appropriate to us, but somehow truly being human is joining those two together, at least in Lewis's conception, and certainly St. Augustine's too. There was a question back here.
When I first read Lewis, I was in college, and when I read him, I thought, well, this should be canonized. Of course, I was about like 20 years old, you know, I didn't know what canon, how it come about. I just knew that word because I'd gone to my first theology classes, Protestant theology classes. But it just awakened something inside of me, which also led to conversion to Orthodoxy. But what I wanted to, it seems to me that it's because there's an objective truth that is in the world, that is part of God's creation, that he somehow has been able to insightfully, in all of his writings, say, this is true. I knew this was true. No one said it like this before, but this is true. Would he say that it's because there's an objective truth? Like, I heard someone say this before, and I'm not sure if this is what. Is there a blue? Would he say there's a blue somewhere that is the blue? And all blues are shadows of that blue. Is that where the Shadowland idea comes from, or is that some?
It's the old question of how much of a Platonist is Lewis.
Yeah.
And you know, I would say it's fair to say he's very, very Platonist. I wouldn't go so far as to say that he is a Platonist or even a Neoplatonist. But yes, you know, if you read The Great Divorce, true reality is more concrete than the reality in which we have.
Does that inform this discussion that you're having? That there's some appropriate response because there's an actual reality.
Yes.
And to which we, and we're related in relationship. We're created in relationship to that.
Yes.
In a certain way.
Yes, and you know he finds this not only in Western culture, but he also finds this in Chinese culture and Hindu culture. And he gives the example in this book of worship, and he says. One of the fascinating things about Hindu worship is that the Hindus believe their worship had to pattern a true and eternal and objective worship that lay beyond the earth. In other words, they were participating in some kind of eternal worship. Just like as in the Old Testament, the Jews would have thought their temple was a kind of pattern of the heavenly temple. That we have to conform somehow to that which is more abiding or more true. And this holds true in the moral realm for Lewis as well. There are what he calls eternal moral platitudes, first platitudes, that are like the periodic table of the elements. They're so foundational as to be just there.
Is that an orthodox thought?
I would say in large part that is very much an orthodox belief, that when we worship, it's not merely a gathering of 25, if it's normal, 50 if we're lucky, Christians in a small house. But rather, you know, we join the angels and we join the saints and we participate in the never-ending worship of the eternal God, because it can't ever stop. Church doesn't stop and start in heaven. It's always going on, and the angels are always singing holy, holy, holy. And we just happen to enjoy that for a little bit. And we do our best to manifest that in a kind of epiphany.
And also to follow up kind of with what you're saying, I think that, you know, I think everyone who's read Mere Christianity at first goes, wow, it's so simple. How could I never have gotten this before? But it's all about a path. I mean, like you're talking about the abolition of man, you have to be able to get these sort of moral feelings to be able to feel what you ought. And you have to crawl before you can walk. And in the sense to get to the great divorce where the grass doesn't pierce your feet, you know, we're all on a different journey, and some of us get to that stage after, you know, maybe a few years, and for some of us, you know, we reach our 70s and we think, wow, I'm going to get the first steps down here. But I think, part of the problem is trying to rush it. You know, it's when it's authentic, and when it's not authentic, then we're just catering to our own, you know, we're not worshiping the real God, we're worshiping the God we made up.
Other thoughts?
I was going to speak to the truth and reality and material subjectives. Just and for those of you who've already read Abolition of Man and some of the others and wanting to read more, I picked up recently a fabulous book of sort of an anthology of some of George MacDonald's writings. Now, Lewis wrote an anthology. I had that one. This one is by a contemporary editor, and it's a lot from MacDonald's unspoken sermons, but the name of the book is The Truth in Jesus, and it starts off with an essay by George MacDonald. That, for those of you who don't know, George MacDonald was, you should say, one of Lewis's primary spiritual and literary mentors through his writings. And Lewis himself said that he learned so much of his beliefs and Christian beliefs and his views from MacDonald. And this essay, The Truth in Jesus, he starts out, MacDonald was also trained as a scientist. He had a college degree in science, and he kept up with science. I didn't know that. And so the Industrial Revolution and electricity and all. And The Truth in Jesus, he has a great section. He's talking about levels of truth, and he starts out with a mere fact, like matter is solid. And then he gives examples of higher aspects of that truth. And he says he thinks maybe the ultimate truth, or one of the ultimate truths that we learn from matter is solid, is that God is solid and unchanging and trustworthy and strong. And so he's saying this is one of the reasons, and speaking of redeeming the whole cosmos and God being concerned with the whole cosmos, is that these are not just facts. God has embodied truths in all the cosmos that we should have there, and we should learn them and have the right response to and think properly about, not merely the cold modern scientific rationalism. Yes, fine, that's you know, we can describe it, that's the end of it. Yeah. But no, as that God and in Jesus and Christianity, there are these higher truths that.
It's a great point. One of the funny things about that episode of the resurrected Jesus coming into the room where the disciples are locked in their room praying,
yes,
is everyone thinks Jesus is a ghost. Mm-hmm. It's the more solid, yep, person that's walking through the ghostly walls. That's a very Lewisian inversion of facticity and making the eternal world more fact-like than our supposed world of matter. To parallel the world of matter, though, Lewis, as one of his colleagues also liked to recall, Lewis was intensely interested in quality. If the empiricist or the scientist is really keen on the world of weight, measurement, physical reality, Lewis's tendency of mind was to look at the quality of a certain thing. And by this, you know, take an example. What is the quality of the humidity in this room right now? That would be a very Lewisian thing. Or to say, let's compare the quality of the humidity today with the quality of the humidity tomorrow, even if it's only a few degrees different in terms of empirical science, it has a different quality. For weather, this was a common Lewis approach. A rainy day on June the 15th is not the same as a rainy day on June the 16th. There's a very different quality to them. And part of training the soul to respond to the world around one aesthetically is being receptive to the world of quality as well as quantity. And that's a very hard thing to do. It's a very hard thing to do. Random joke. When Lewis was walking by a beggar in Oxford and gave him some money, one of his friends didn't like this and said, "Why, Jack, why did you do that? You know he's going to spend that money on drink." And Lewis replied, "Well, if I kept the money, I would have done the same." we can talk about other things in Lewis besides subjective truth and so forth, but
have you, sure. Somebody else, Planet Narnia, are you familiar with that writing at all?
I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah.
Have you studied this Michael Ward and his writings on that?
For full disclosure, Michael Ward read a poem at my wedding, so I not only know Michael, I know him pretty well. He went around the States all last year talking at different universities and venues to discuss his discovery, his literary discovery about the Narnia tales, and I think it's just awesome. It's an amazing, amazing insight into the qualities of the Narnian tales. I'll give you just a little snapshot and let you read the book on your own. Michael was talking one night with an Anglican bishop who happened to be reading to him a passage from a man named St. Silouan. And St. Silouan made the rather dazzling comment that the perfect Christian only speaks that which the Holy Spirit places on his or her heart. And Michael went home in a kind of reverie, thinking about this quotation. And it was around 11 or 11:30 at night. He sat down in his bed and pulled off a book of Lewis's poetry, open to a poem that Lewis had written in 1935 called The Planets. And he started to read this poem. And he came across the line about winter past and guilt forgiven. And it kind of perked his ears up because he realized that's very much what's going on in the line The Witch and the Wardrobe. And he went on to read the rest of the poem and realized that many, many things that were respective to each planet were also respective to each Narnia book. And in fact, it turns out that the seven medieval planets that Lewis talked about endlessly in his introductions to the medieval worlds in his Oxford lecture series, and wrote about endlessly in his Discarded Image, it turns out that the effects of the planets that Lewis had in a scholarly vision, he had woven into his Narnia books in a kind of imaginative quality. So, he stayed up late that night and teased out a lot of the connections and then made it to a very big and learned book called Planet Narnia, where he discusses how you can pretty easily correlate each one of the Narnia books to each one of the seven medieval planets, and it works. So enjoy it. It's a really remarkable discovery. It's, you know, the first time in 50 years that someone's had something radically new to say about the Narnia tales, and it rescues the Narnia tales from the idea that they're just cheap allegory or cheap Christian symbolism or a kind of subterfuge in order to get young people to believe in the Christian faith. That they are something like that, but they're a lot more learned and a lot more clever than anyone has ever thought or even discovered for 50 years. So enjoy Michael Ward's book. It's a superb book. Superb book.
And planetnarnia.com, he's got that's his website where he gives some little excerpts from it and talks about it too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in all his fiction. If you start to get on this trail, you'll see the use of the planets in That Hideous Strength and in other works as well. So, but I won't steal his thunder. It really is thunder. Yeah. Anything anything else on Lewis? You can open it up to any subject on Lewis. Not that I can answer, but we can at least make a discussion.
I just heard that Tolkien and Lewis had differences of opinion about the validity of the Narnia series.
Yeah.
Could you comment on that?
Yeah, sure. As a lot of the biographers of both J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis have noted, Tolkien had a very severe critical mind about Lewis's books. He didn't like most of them. Indeed, Lewis dedicated the Screwtape Letters to Tolkien, and Tolkien wasn't so pleased. On the one hand, it shows enough of a friendship where he could say, "I don't like that," and not risk saying, "I don't like you." I mean, they were real literary critics who could make objective comments about the work and not feel like you were attacking the person. But on the other hand, Tolkien was a very, very severe literary critic, period. It wasn't just Lewis's books. You know, virtually everything after Shakespeare, and somewhat including Shakespeare, to Tolkien was suspect. I wish I were joking. So that he disliked the Narnia tales doesn't surprise many people. His critique that the Narnia tales were a hodgepodge, as he called them, is a little less just once you read Planet Narnia, because a lot of the symbolism that Lewis is up to actually comes from the planetary influence. And you'll see that Lewis, who didn't have a hodgepodge mind, he was one of the most systematic, logical, and clear thinkers that you know, and he certainly didn't make hodgepodge imaginative ones either. So I think Tolkien is perhaps mistaken there. By the way, Tolkien was a brilliant man. In fact, many of the Oxford dons I met said he was one of the most brilliant linguists of the century. But he was incomprehensible in public speech. And even in the Inklings, they made his son, Christopher, read the chapters from The Lord of the Rings because no one could understand J.R.R. Tolkien. And that if he were subject to modern standards of university lecturing, he would have been fired, said one of his Oxford colleagues. But I found one fun story at Merton, which is the college where Tolkien taught and actually lived at the end of his life. And there were still some old dons at Merton, still are, who remembered him. In fact, one wonderful history professor who remembered playing squash with him on the squash courts. And he said that there were four people on the squash court, Tolkien and another older professor, and then two of these younger junior professors. And that what Tolkien lacked in youth and spryness, he would make up for by hacking the back of the knees of the younger colleagues on the squash court. So he's quite a character. There's lots of stories about him, too.
Well, Lewis obviously was a big fan of mythic tales.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, a lot of the works that he did, Culwin and Narnia, the Friends trilogy, but also Blindness and other things he did, was, I think, in a way to try to bring back the kind of mythic quality to get people, to be able to accept the myth of Christianity, a true myth of Christianity,
mm-hmm.
And because of that, he was, along with Tolkien, kind of the father of the genres now of fantasy, and one can even say science fiction in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
At the time at which Tolkien and Lewis wrote that, there wasn't a lot of other fish in the sea other than MacDonald and a few other older Greek and Roman tales.
Mm-hmm.
But now it seems that these genres are flourishing.
Mm-hmm.
And speculative fiction is one of the most popular things out there.
Yeah.
What do you think Lewis would have to say about what he and Tolkien have unearthed?
Yeah, it's a good question. I remember asking a colleague of Lewis's named Rachel Trickett, who has now since died, but I asked her about the fact that Tolkien's work, which is so masterful, so commanding, so exquisitely good and learned, and rereadable, why do we have so much junk fantasy after Tolkien's effort? And her response was simply to say that works of genius always inspire loads of inferior progeny. And that's just the truth. And I think in the realm of fantasy that may be the case, but there's certainly lots of good fantasy out there, too. So we just have to recognize what it's about.
I just wonder, though, in the sense that I think Lewis and Tolkien wrote a lot of that to get people to think about the ultimate questions and to think about life in a mythic way.
Mm.
I think now, as postmodern beings, we've kind of anesthetized ourselves because all we do, what woman out there has not read Twilight? We're filled with tales of vampires and elves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost, to a lot of people, more real than, the story of Christ and the apostles.
I'd be careful just to say that Lewis had very, very, very cultured tastes. You know, he was way more cultured a person than any of the biographies give him credit for. It's really hard to imagine almost the aristocratic breeding of this man, and I mean that. He came from a very prominent family in Ireland and enjoyed an education that was really exquisite. And the training that went on in the Oxford of his day was a little different from what we do to our students in today's university. So he was very, very cultured and certainly could enjoy works of high literature and high art, but he was not at all afraid of reading works of popular art and works of popular fiction. He was well known, in fact, when he was giving final exams to his students to just be reading the latest children's story that had come out. So I think he, too, would have gobbled it up. But like he says about bad philosophy and good philosophy, so, you know, the real antidote to bad philosophy is just to be fully inoculated with good philosophy. Then you can go ahead and read it. It'll be okay. And he had read enough good literature to be fairly ironclad against bad literature. But he would have known it pretty quickly. And it wouldn't have affected his taste all that much. Sometimes you have to like a junk novel or a junk story or a good movie. That's yeah, yeah. I mean, let's put it this way.
What was that?
So it's like eating a candy bar.
In his day, and in the Oxford Dons of his day, someone like Charles Dickens would have been thought not high literature but vulgar literature, vulgar in the sense of the common people, and even the radio, the BBC broadcast, both Dorothy Sayers and Lewis thought that the BBC was a little bit déclassé. You don't go as a learned Oxford Don who's extremely cultured and go pander to the masses. It was a step down. It really was. And this hurts him professionally. There's a lot of reasons why he doesn't get a professorship, but that's part of it. Playing to the masses doesn't help. So all that being said, he still loved Dickens, thought he was, you know, a genius and that kind of thing. And I don't think he would have been wholly averse to giving a really fair hearing to a lot of what's out there in the world of fantasy and science fiction.
It seems to me there is a real a difference between the kind of fantasy and mythic thinking that you find in Lewis and Tolkien and the sort of thing that we have now, and that difference is very closely related to our original topic with respect to the idea that there is an appropriateness between how things are and the things that you feel and say about it.
Mm-hmm.
And their understanding, Lewis and Tolkien's, would be that myth and fantasy are able to say truths about how things actually are.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the contemporary idea, almost the definition of fantasy, is that it's arbitrary and it can be however you want. That's the difference, it seems to me.
It is a huge difference. And maybe it's worth adding a little mystery, since I'm coming from an Orthodox perspective. We have to add in a little mystery. When Lewis wrote about the genesis of the book, The Screwtape Letters, he writes to his brother Warney and said, in the middle of a church service, in the middle of the sermon, in fact, I wish this idea could have come at a more seasonable time, the idea came to me to have a senior devil instructing a junior devil in the arts of temptation. And what really strikes me is the phrasing, the idea came to me. In works of genius, and if you look at the origins of The Lord of the Rings and Tolkien's almost visionary description of what he saw in Middle-earth in his early youth, it's almost like, if you want to put it this way, his ideas were pictated to him. And when it comes to Lewis's Narnia tales, he says it all began with a picture. You know, a faun in the forest of a snowy wood, carrying parcels, a queen on a sledge, a lamppost in the forest. Paralandra began with a picture of floating islands. The lion comes in when he starts having nightmares of lions at a very difficult point in his life. And I agree about the shaping of fantasy to an appropriateness and an objectivity in the world, but I think part of the specialness of Tolkien and Lewis is that they were just inspired in a certain way that the literary hack who's going to produce the next novel for $10,000 isn't quite inspired. And they had the gifts to make that inspiration into something, the 90% of work that comes after some beautiful pictures coming into your head. And Lewis said the same thing about the Pilgrim's Progress. For John Bunyan, the idea came to him. And that's a potent thing, because Lewis is aware that his imagination is not a closed system. It's not him making the ideas. The imagination is an open atmosphere where planes and comets and asteroids can come in willy-nilly. Or as he says in Mere Christianity, the thoughts that come into your mind can be divine or they can be diabolical. You're not fully in charge of the atmosphere of your rational world any more than you're fully in charge of the pictures that flash in your head. What you do with them is another matter, but some of the quality and the power of his imaginative work surely comes from, well, what came into his head. Other thoughts, queries, Joffrey?
I was just going to say, you know, I think Lewis is courageous, just as a man, to go to, in my mind, places where many others would just be overwhelmed. And his writing has kind of that kind of openness and a vulnerability, I think, sometimes when he's making his arguments that few other authors that I know have.
He's very, very courageous. Very, very courageous indeed. He loved that quotation by Chesterton of, we become taller when we bow. And I think for someone of such prodigious learning and such prodigious abilities, his bowing, quite frankly, his coming down a bit and trying to put Christianity in ordinary language has tremendous power. There's a funny story about his first lecture on an Air Force base where he gave his first lecture to effectively soldiers. And the title of his lecture was a very Oxonian title. It was Soteriology in the Letters of St. Paul. Imagine going to an army base and giving that title. And it was really dull, and he could tell it was dull, and no one was paying attention until he started using the language of prostitutes and pawnbrokers. And then people, you know, clued in. When he came down and used the images that people were going to think in and the language that people could understand, it works magnificently. But it was also an achieved effort to come down to that level. One of the things my tutor said, my tutor was Lewis's last pupil, a wonderful man named Francis Warner, still alive. He said that for Lewis, as with any great artist, there's a simplicity on the other side of complexity. There's an achieved simplicity. And Lewis was the kind of person who had gone through enough complexity that he could digest it and make a kind of achieved simplicity. And when you read the lapidary prose of something like the Screwtape Letters or Mere Christianity, you realize this is not simple writing. This is simple writing that is achieved simple writing. It's extremely clear. Kind of like why the Russians won't let a really great author write children's stories until they're old. You can't write for children, you can't write for the young ones until you've gone through the complexities and give them something of value on paper. Back there, sorry.
Could you draw some parallels between that idiot strength in the abolition man, and then just as how it seems like it's to some extent an apocalyptic vision of an expression of post-humanism character?
Yeah, sure.
And then also, to what extent, after reading the book several times, it seems like several of the characters that are more the expression of the it seems like there's a demonic aspect to them, or a demonic working in the Institute, or just, yeah, how does that interact?
Before we get started, Deacon Andrew, there's a lot to chew on, and I'm actually really looking forward to hear what your answer is. Maybe we can make this the last one.
Sure.
I believe you're going to stick around a little bit for a little while,
sure.
Is that right?
Yeah,
maybe?
As you need.
Cool. So I guess when you're done, we can go ahead and maybe spread around a little bit, head out of the smoking room or the porch or whatever, and Deacon Andrew will still be here. You can still bend his ear a little bit.
Okay, yeah.
Thanks so much.
That's great. That hideous strength, or as the other critics like to say, that hideous book. I love the book. Yeah, I think it's a fantastic, thrilling novel. And, you know, he sets out to mix the regular and the normal with the supernatural because it's just the mixture he appreciated. In the works of Charles Williams, but also as reflective of our own reality. Remember I said we're both man and angel, both animal and angel, rather, and we have our feet in two worlds. So in that hideous strength, you do have an intersection of the world of the sciences with the world of spirits, and he does fictionally express his book, The Abolition of Man, in a number of ways. One basic way would be this. None of the main villains, Frost and Wither and Feverstone, none of the main villains believe in any sort of objectivity. And indeed, when the main character, Mark Studdick, is captured and imprisoned, they put him in a room which is nearly a square, but it's not quite a square, and has some dots on the ceiling that are something like in a pattern, but you can't quite make into a pattern. What they're trying to do, of course, is to de-objectify Mark's view of the world. And so the whole scientific enterprise and the villains of that book are trying to remove the chest of Mark, his objective response to the moral qualities of the world and the physical qualities of the world and the beautiful qualities of the world. Indeed, Fairy Hardcastle is purposefully grotesque, such that they can then remake man. The point about having maximum scientific capabilities in a human genome project or an exquisitely worked out psychology is that, well, you can make what you want. But if you don't have a moral law that guides what you make what you want, you will end up making something rather alarming. So Lewis goes on to say, if the arch scientist, the one with the maximum amount of power, gives up the moral law, gives up objective truth, what's going to control him? In The Abolition of Man, he says what's going to control him is his willy-nilly feeling. He's given up reason, he's given up his heart, the only thing he's got is his appetites. But The Abolition of Man, as you suggested, proposes an even more sobering vision. It's not just feelings that are going to control him. When you open up, when you let go of truth, it's not going to be a vacuum. Falsehood can possess you just as well as truth can possess you. And when you let go of beauty, nature does abhor a vacuum, and the ugly will rush to fill it. So his villains are quite rightly overtaken, possessed, as you see partly in The Unman and Paralandra, and certainly in Wither and Frost and Feverstone, they're literally possessed by the spirits they voluntarily abdicated themselves to. And that's the invasion of the supernatural to the natural world of the nice. So he's not just playing with ideas. He gives you, I think, a wonderful and thrilling book. It mattered enough to him that he would give up, you know, that university career to publish books like this. Mere Christianity and science fiction books are really going to hurt your case in Oxford to stay as a professor. But it mattered enough to him. His way of fighting in World War II as a 40-plus-year-old man, his way of fighting was to fight in the world of ideas because he knew he could. And he gave up a lot for that. But he realized the fight wasn't about the war, and the honors weren't about the professorship. The only honors that he cared about were the honors that would be given in the weight of glory, the well-done, good and faithful servant that God might give him. And the real war for him was the war on the inside, that inner moral atmosphere we were talking about. When the thoughts come in, when the pictures come in, and what do you do with it? Which ones will you be possessed by? Which ones will captivate you? What beauty will direct your life? So, he gave up a lot for that. So thank you for listening, and thank you for asking such good questions, and what a delight to have you all here. There was one fatal flaw, by the way, with The Bird and the Baby. It's not like what it was. There's one fatal flaw with The Bird and the Baby, though, when the Inklings were meeting there, and that's that they were kicked out for not buying enough drinks. So on that note, why don't we stop, and I'll let you all disperse and enjoy each other, too.